Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Vicki Mazzone. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life. On today's show, Denise Kowalczyk tackles an incredibly intimate and difficult topic of conversation, the topic of money. That's coming up later in the show on broadband. On the She-Ra Solution, Kristen Thiel honors five women who were born to climb mountains. And Emma Laurie talks about expressions of anger and emotion in our culture on Let's Stop for a Minute. But first, I present some background about two special days in the month of May. May Day, May 1st, which is today, and Mother's Day, which falls on May 19th this year. There are two different versions of May Day. Both are celebrated on May 1st, and both are celebrated in many countries around the world. One is an ancient spring tradition, and the other, a more recent political tradition. The political version of May Day was formally named International Workers' Day and started in the United States in Chicago in the 1880s. It is also known by Labor Day. Here in the U.S., Labor Day is celebrated on the first Monday in September. But back to the origins of May Day. Starting in the 1860s, there was a movement created by the working class to propose a new, shorter workday, the 8-hour workday. At the time, 10 to 16-hour days were the common practice, and working conditions were unsafe. Many workers died or were severely injured at their places of work. This was the result of the rise of industrial production in the United States, and Chicago was a hub of industry. Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions held their national convention in 1884 in Chicago. They proclaimed that 8 hours shall constitute a legal day's labor from and after May 1, 1886. On May 1, 1886, approximately 300,000 workers across the United States walked off their jobs to protest. In Chicago, which was ground zero for the 8-hour workday movement, nearly 100,000 workers walked off their jobs over a period of 2 days. All was peaceful until May 3, 1886, when fights broke out at the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company. Police and strikers were involved, and two McCormick employees were killed. A rally was organized for Haymarket Square on the evening of May 4th. The crowd was quite peaceful until after the speeches, when police arrived in full force and ordered everyone to disperse. A homemade bomb was thrown into the path of the police, and gunshots immediately followed from both sides. Several people were killed and many were injured. The square was vacated after about 5 minutes. In the wake of this riot, there was a backlash against the unions. Several organizers were brought to trial, and 4 of them were executed by hanging. The 8-hour workday movement continued to gain momentum. Several unions won an 8-hour workday for their workers in 1898 and 1900. In 1905, the 8-hour workday was the norm for the printing industry, although many Americans still worked 12 to 14-hour days. In 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which limited the work week to 44 hours. May Day continues to be observed worldwide as a day of demonstration and protest. The other May Day, the ancient celebration of spring and flowers, dates back to at least 500 BC and probably even earlier than that. In Rome, the goddess of flowers, Flora, was celebrated on April 27th. In Gaelic culture, the evening of April 30th is known as Beltane, which translates to lucky fire. It is most commonly known as Beltane signals the start of the summer season. Historically, it involved the symbolic use of fire to bless cattle and livestock. Both cattle and people would leap over fires for luck. More recently, the Roman Catholic Church observes May Day with devotions and celebrations to Mary, the Mother of God, also known as the Blessed Virgin. Children will create crowns of flowers to be placed upon the statue of Mary's head. Modern May Day traditions in both Europe and North America include dancing around the Maypole and crowning the Queen of May. The May Queen is a girl who rides or walks at the front of a parade, and she wears a crown of flowers and a white dress to symbolize purity. There are, and have been, many traditional celebrations of mothers and motherhood throughout the world for thousands of years. From the Roman festival of Hilaria, which is an ancient festival on the spring equinox in honor of the goddess Cybele, who's the mother of the gods, to the Christian Mothering Sunday celebration. The modern Mother's Day began in the United States by a woman in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her name was Anna Reeves Jarvis. She founded the holiday in 1908. Jarvis created a holiday to honor motherhood and family life and to remember her mother who had recently passed away. Anna Reeves Jarvis was originally from West Virginia. She moved to Philadelphia in 1892. After her mother died, she started the Mother's Day movement. It grew out of Jarvis having a special church service for her mother back in West Virginia to honor her mother's memory. And then it was followed by Jarvis establishing the Mother's Day International Association Group. The group embarked on a letter-writing campaign to establish Mother's Day as a holiday. The campaign was successful. Mother's Day was given federal recognition by Congress in 1914. The resolution, signed by President Woodrow Wilson, proclaimed Mother's Day as a national holiday to be celebrated on the second Sunday in May. As Mother's Day grew in popularity, it also grew in commercialism. Greeting cards, candy, and flowers, especially the white carnation. Anna Reeves Jarvis did not profit from Mother's Day, and she was not pleased with the commercialism, even trying to get the day revoked. About that white carnation, Jarvis used it for Mother's Day to symbolize truth, purity, and the charity of mother love. Today, the wearing of a white carnation symbolizes that the wearer's mother has passed away, while a pink carnation indicates a mother who is living. In the 1940s, Jarvis was placed in Marshall Square Sanitarium in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Although she detested all of the commercialism associated with Mother's Day, ironically, people connected with the floral and greeting card industries were the ones who paid her bills while she was in there. She died in the sanitarium in 1948. Anna Jarvis is buried beside her mother at West Laurel Hill Cemetery in Ballackinwood, Montgomery County. There is a marker erected to Jarvis and Mother's Day located at Market and Juniper Streets in downtown Philadelphia, right outside of City Hall. This year, in the United States, Mother's Day is Sunday, May 12th. This is a song by Brandi Carlile entitled The Mother.
Welcome to the end of being alone inside your mind. You're tethered to another and you worried all the time. You always knew the melody, but you never heard it rhyme. She's fair and she is quiet, Lord. She doesn't look like me. She made me love the morning. She's a holiday at sea. The New York streets are as busy as they always used to be. But I am the mother of Evangeline. The first things that she took from me were selfishness and sleep. She broke a thousand heirlooms I was never meant to keep. She filled my life with color, canceled plans and trashed my car. None of that was ever who we are. Outside of my windows are the mountains and the snow. I hold you while you're sleeping and I wish that I could go. All my roadie friends are out accomplishing their dreams. But I am the mother of Evangeline. And they've still got their morning paper on their coffee and their time. And they still enjoy their evenings with the skeptics and the wine. Oh, but all the wonders I have seen, I will see a second time. from inside of the ages through your eyes. You are not an accident where no one thought it through. The world that stood against us made us mean to fight for you. And when we chose your name, we knew that you'd fight the power too. You're nothing short of magical and beautiful. I'll never hit the big time without you. So they can keep their treasure and their ties to the machine. 'Cause I am the mother of Evangeline. They can keep their treasure and their ties to the machine. 'Cause I am the mother of Evangeline.
And now, it's time for Broadband, our show within a show, hosted by contributor Denise Kowalczyk. On today's segment, the practical and spiritual aspects of money and philanthropy. What does having a rich life mean? Here's Denise with Broadband.
Hello and welcome to Broadband, a segment that is part feature soul and part food for thought. It features personal reflection and information about some great things going on in the community, because you need to take care of yourself before you can take care of the world. On today's segment, Nancy Alder returns with Bringing Myth to Life. This month, she reflects on the riches in life. I also have a song by Rhode Island band, The Callouts. But first, I interviewed Arlene Kogan about her new book, Give to Live, Make a Charitable Gift You Never Imagined. Arlene is a certified financial planner in the Portland area who identified a need for a go-to guide on how to engage in philanthropy. Arlene, welcome to Broadband.
Denise, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here with you.
So we're going to talk today a little bit about your book, Give to Live, Make a Charitable Gift You Never Imagined. And my first obvious question for me is, why did you write this book and why was it so important to do so?
You know, first of all, Denise, thank you for having me on the show. It's a delight to be here. And that's an excellent question. Why did I write this book? And it's really a combination of my life's career and work. I started out in the trust and investment world, working with individual families and doing a lot of trust administration and business development. And then, then I had two daughters, and we moved from the East Coast, Connecticut, to Portland, Oregon. And during that time, I stayed home with my two girls. And reflecting back on my career on the East Coast in the banking and investment world, I experienced sexual harassment, the glass ceiling, and wage discrimination. Having two daughters really inspired me to lead by example and make sure that they knew they could have careers where they got paid well and they didn't have to deal with any of the BS that I dealt with. So after spending a few years at home with my girls and not wanting to go back into that corporate environment, I saw a career coach, and everything came up philanthropy and benevolence. And with that information, I was able to find a position with the Oregon Community Foundation, which is the sixth largest community foundation in the country. It was a dream job, and I was able to help people facilitate gifts they never imagined. But there was one big gap. I noticed that many advisors did not know how to talk their clients through a difficult family situation so that the client could handle that situation and leave a charitable gift. In the client's mind, it was impossible to do. And I realized that there needed to be a tool, an instrument for advisors to give to their clients and for clients to read, individuals like you and me to read, so they could understand charitable giving and break it down into manageable pieces. And after being at the Community Foundation for 9 years, dream job, I decided it was time to go out on my own and share this information with the masses so we can all make a charitable gift we never imagined.
And what I love about this book, it's chock full of practical brass tacks ideas of how you can do that. But here is another question. Is philanthropy only for rich people?
Absolutely not. Why we like to think it is, a good colleague of mine has reflected that over the years, you know, philanthropy is for everyone, people with modest means and multi-millions. And what this book does is it shows people of modest means, not the millionaires and billionaires, but thousandaires and mass affluent, how to make a gift they never imagined. And for most people to truly make a gift they never imagined, it is going to be through their estate plan and through their legacy. Because most of us need that money while we're living.
I hear you, sister. But what a great idea to look into the future. So if and when you plan for your future to possibly consider establishing a legacy of support. Now, what can we dig a little bit deeper into what your personal ethos is around money? Would you be willing to share that with us?
What do you mean by ethos?
Well, talking about money, I mean, I was actually uncomfortable, even I have to admit, having this conversation because it's about money. No one likes to talk about money. Well, most people, okay? How do you look at it as a way as it should be as natural to talk about as what movie you're going to see or what you're going to make for your lunch that day?
Yeah. Okay. Well, growing up, my parents grew up during the Depression, and my mother had to quit her job, quit high school to become a secretary to help support her family. So growing up, I always learned that money was a great tool for you if you managed it well. So I've always been very focused on money as a tool to get our desired objectives, and know that if people are financially literate, then they can really create outcomes that truly are positive for them. So mine was a matter of being good with numbers, having an example for my mom, and just listening to many people along the way with their stories, how they made money, how they wanted to make a difference in the world, and combining them. And it's been a journey. It didn't happen overnight, but it's developed over time.
And I guess what I think I probably know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you ever too young or too old to think about philanthropy?
You know, there's hard science that philanthropy causes joy. Giving money away actually promotes physical happiness. And there's hard science that it's happening in your brain and it comes from your prefrontal cortex. Why would anyone want to limit themselves to not have the joy of giving during their life, no matter what age? And when we talk about philanthropy, it doesn't have to be giving of just money. But when you're younger and might not have the resources, that may look like volunteering your time.
Great point. So how would you recommend for adults, whether it's an auntie or a parent or a family friend, to teach kids about the philosophy of philanthropy?
So there's a great chapter in my book, Multi-Generational Giving, that really talks about some grandparents who had, you know, a couple of generations of children to teach about philanthropy. And what they did with their grandchildren is, you know, at Thanksgiving, they said, you know, yeah, for Christmas, you'll get something, but we want to instill your values. And we want you to think about between Thanksgiving and Christmas, an organization that you care about and present it to the family. And it was awesome. The grandparents saw their little granddaughter come up with a little brochure saying, like, I want to support the animals. And from there, this has been an annual, a tradition, and it has brought the family together, not only just for individual giving, but also for larger givings with the family.
What a great story, and what a great idea.
Another great way to teach philanthropy to children is there are a ton of books out there, especially for the real young ones, on giving that you can purchase to give as a gift to teach the value of helping out in generosity and kindness. And another great thing, especially for our millennials, there are so many corporations out there that will, you buy one and they give one to someone in need. Tom's Shoes is a great example of that. And there are many others out there. So a way to be spending our dollars and making a difference is to look for those types of companies which are truly making a difference as well as selling products.
Another fantastic suggestion. Could you rattle off just a few, if you will, financial tools that you've discovered or touch on in your book, Give to Life, Make a Charitable Gift You've Never Imagined, that you've sort of noticed as being really clever tools to help facilitate philanthropy?
You know, there are many tools. The most popular tool, I think, that can not only accomplish your goals, but also start to include family members, or donor-advised funds. Donor-advised funds are, I describe them as mini private foundations. You have all the fun of philanthropy without any of the administrative and investment headache. What you do is you create a fund either with a wirehouse, Schwab Fidelity, there are many community foundations locally. And then from there, you can make grant recommendations to support the charities you care about. And many of those platforms allow you to be to advise, as well as your children and grandchildren to advise on those funds. So it can be a multi-generational vehicle.
So this is my final question for you, Arlene. What would you suggest could be the very first step for someone to take as they venture out into the world of philanthropy?
Great question. As one ventures out into the world of philanthropy, there are so many directions to go in. But what you first need to identify are, what are the core causes near and dear to your heart? Whether it be the environment, education, social services, you need to reach out and explore some of the local organizations doing that work and really meet them to see if they're like-minded and like-valued people. And if they are, that's when you go a little deeper. Philanthropy is like a muscle, and it matures and gets stronger over time. One thing that happened at the Community Foundation, I would meet people, single, dual income, no children, and they would create a philanthropic plan and a fund agreement that would kick in and support causes they cared about. And then I would encourage them, and that would happen at their death, I would encourage them to create a current fund to actually participate in philanthropy actively. And then after a year, I would compare their current giving with what they wrote that they wanted when they died. And the two did not match. So philanthropy is a muscle that you need to practice and reflect on to ensure that you can have effective philanthropy.
To learn more about Arlene's book, Give to Live, Make a Charitable Gift You Never Imagined, check out our website, arlenekogan.com. Each month, Nancy Alder shares a reflection on a topic, and on this month's Bringing Myth to Life, she offers this perspective on what true wealth could be.
There is an old Japanese folktale about a young student who is captivated by a stunningly beautiful woman who insists he finish his studies before they marry. He hits the books with an eager heart, encouraged by her love letters and gifts. As he nears the end of his studies, she tells him that they must wait until he gets a good job. So he throws himself into his work, motivated by her patient adoration. Each time he achieves the goal she sets, she places another one before him, until he becomes one of the most respected men in the land. Heartsick with longing and losing faith, he goes to her a final time, and before his eyes, she turns into the Buddha and, laughing, runs away. What do we seek with the intensity of this student, certain that just beyond the next hurdle is the bliss we seek? For most of us, money serves as either a primary goal or a necessary means to an end. Those of us who aren't motivated by a nicer car, better clothes, and bigger house still need to exchange wages for food and shelter, and often wish we could afford better neighborhoods, vacations, more education, and opportunities for personal growth. We dream of saving enough to be free of the obligation to work, or at least to grow old in comfort. Yet what most people at the end of life crave, regardless of how much they have saved, is companionship and the sense of a life well lived. And a meaningful life isn't free from struggle, obligation, or sacrifice. An independently wealthy friend of mine laments about the projects trapped in his mind because the need for a paycheck doesn't force him out of his complacency and into the world. Just like the Japanese student, sometimes the effort of doing what we must to get what we want creates something far more valuable to both ourselves and the world. So the next time you're wishing for a little extra cash or a lot more free time, just remember the Buddha laughing at the end of it all, and take a moment to appreciate what is being born in you through your struggle, and how that shared sense of humanity is what connects us all.
Bringing Myth to Life was presented by Nancy Alder. You can learn more about her work of exploring mystical spiritual traditions and psychology with a focus on shamanic practice, shadow work, and applied mythology by visiting her website, innerwoven.net. Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Broadband. Thanks to my guest, Arlene Kogan, for joining me, and Nancy Alder for her contribution to the program, and thanks so much for listening. I'm going to close out with a bit of music by the band The Callouts. It hails from the Ocean State, also known as Rhode Island. Here's their song, California. Have a great day, and thanks for listening.
That was Denise Kowalczyk with Broadband. This month's question here on The Politics of Living is about money. Actually, it's questions, plural, since it was hard to choose just one question. How do you view money? How uncomfortable is it to talk about money? What does wealth mean to you? And how do you handle having an unexpected windfall? Do you save or do you spend? Tell us your thoughts at kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living to leave a comment, or email us at tpol@kboo.org. The She-Ra Solution is a monthly biography of women, past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Maria Teresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published June 16, 2016, in The Atlantic. Are you ready to do some spring and summer exploring outside? Kristen talks about five women in Bolivia who defied the odds and found themselves at the top of the world. Here's Kristen Thiel.
Welcome to May. Around here, this means bursts of blooms and the beginning of more sunny than cloudy hours in the day. It also means the chance to explore our beautiful surroundings. I love hiking and backpacking. I put on my quick drying pants, my odor wicking UVA bouncing shirt, and my boots with soles ready to chomp into the earth. This is what I'm comfortable hiking mountains in. It's what I'm used to. It's what I trust to keep me unscratched and unburnt as I go. It also makes me look a world away from the climbers I'm about to tell you about. Of course, these women are also a world away from me in their recent hiking accomplishment. I've never come close to what they've done. Though, I like to think we've taken the same size of indescribable peace, joy, and accomplishment after a trek. On January 23rd, 2019, just a bit further along in the Southern Hemisphere's warm months than we in the Northern are right now, five women from Bolivia summited South America's highest mountain. Aconcagua's peak reaches 22,841 feet. That's impressive in and of itself, but there are lots of fascinating details about these women that make their climb even more interesting. They are ages 42 through 50. That's hardly old, but in a world where so many athletic endeavors seem to be the playground of the super young, we must take note of the strength and determination of these women, with their life experiences, families, jobs, roots, to carve such time for themselves. These women are not athletes. Not by the popularly understood definition, that is. They didn't train for their goal, which, by the way, included multiple summits over 6,000 feet since 2014. By getting gym memberships and squeezing in long hikes between work weeks at the office. They have all been porters and cooks for years in mountain camps in Bolivia. They've spent their lives in the mountains, but sort of the way anyone in a mountainous region might. They had some climbing experience, but while working and living their day-to-day, they'd never hiked just to hike, and they'd never summited. And these women are not white, and they're not from financially well-off families. A lot of people with the means and time to travel and train to climb are. But these women are members of the Aymara group, a people with their own distinct language who have lived in the places we call Bolivia, Peru, and Chile for at least 1,000 years. There are around 1 million Aymara people, but they have long been discriminated against in Bolivia. Even fairly recently, it was considered okay to refuse them entry to certain public spaces and transportation. It took the election of Bolivia's first indigenous president in 2005 for the policies and laws to begin to change. These women's hiking gear was traditional female Aymara dress. Hat, shawl, brooch, earrings, which, quote, are a must, one of the women said, and a long, full skirt. The Cholita Climbers is an all-woman climbing club. The group's name reclaims a derogatory term used by others against the Aymara people. They have 11 members. Five summited Aconcagua. Those five are Lydia Huayas Estrada, Dora Maguaneño Machaca, Ana Leah Gonzalez Magueño, Cecilia Yusko Ayanya, and Elena Quispe Tincutas. I surely did not say those names correctly, but I wanted to attempt. We should say their names. You can see how they're spelled, and also watch a short video about them at the link in the show notes. I recommend it. In the meantime, I leave you with something one of the other climbers, Jimena Lidia Juelas, said. When we go climbing, we feel free from everything. Oh yeah. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with The She-Ra Solution. In this month's edition of Let's Stop for a Minute, ML Laurie explores how all of us can be harmed by cultural messages that interfere with esteem and happiness. Here's ML Laurie with Let's Stop for a Minute.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. In my last segment, I left you with the question, what are the cultural influences that we have in our lives, and how do they affect us, our culture, our lives, and our happiness? So since we are all born as human beings, we are all born only with our hard drive, which tells our body how to work. And since the only really valid true thing about each of us is that we share being human, then think about this. Why can't we first see each other as human beings when we meet? What interferes with this? Well, the interferences come from the software programs we all are taught from birth, which tell us who we are and what the world is. These software programs are unique to each of us and form all our biased, clouded views of all things. So let's stop for a minute and let's think about this. There's a metaphor or analogy of using an onion to kind of symbolize our core, which is our hard drive, and then our many layers we have, which is like our software programs. This onion is often used to talk about how to pull back the different layers of ourselves to better understand who we are or some issue. So where do our layers come from and how are they formed? Well, if we've been talking about for several months about our software programs on our hard drive and how they are learned, in our lives, we encounter more stimulus than we are even aware of. And because we're not capable of taking in all this stimulus, then there are many things that we miss. So the software programs on our hard drive are mainly made up of the things that we are repeatedly taught or encountered or told, like how to write, and the experiences that we had that produced really strong emotions, positive or negative. Emotions are like the save button on our computer. The stronger the emotion is, the more likely it is to be saved in our memory and easily accessed if we want. So all these experiences come together to form who we are and how we see ourselves. They form our sense of self and how we feel about ourselves, our self-esteem. And our self-esteem then affects our outside views and interactions, and thereby our happiness. So our self-esteem, therefore, directly affects our happiness. So let's stop for a minute and let's think about this. So if all these different things we have coming inside to our senses to form who we are and what we think forms our sense of self and others, then how do we increase our happiness? Since our happiness is directly related to our self-esteem, do we need to gain insight into the influences that have come to form it? Well, yes, we do. This is why understanding our cultural influence is so important. After our birth, there are three cultures which each of us encounter that serve as the main basis for the formation of our sense of self. They are our family culture, the male-female culture, and our country culture. Of course, these three cultures blend all together and are difficult to separate. For example, is it your country or your gender or your family culture that's given you the message about whether crying is good or bad? I've felt for a long time that we definitely need liberation for women, but also for men. Most men in Western countries are taught not to cry because it's like a sense of weakness, and often are taught not to show any kind of emotion, but maybe anger. And this stifles men from being able to have a full sense of being human, which involves all the different emotions that human beings have and the need to release through tears. After all, since we are all human beings first, we all have emotions, and we all have the built-in release mechanism of tears. So let's stop for a minute and let's think about this. Let's think about some examples of our cultural influences. I saw a research project once where there was a little boy and a little girl, and they were both wired up to a heart monitor and an EEG to see their brain waves, and then something externally on the skin to read the temperature of their skin. So the children were about 4 or 5 years old, and they were both shown a short video. So first you see the little girl, and she's sitting there, and it's some kind of action video, and she's squirming all around and making all these facial expressions and obviously reacting very strongly to this video. And then they show the same video to the little boy, and the little boy sat there with his elbow resting on his leg and his head resting on his hand, and he showed absolutely no expression. Yet the brain, heart, and skin readings were the same for both children. So afterwards, the researchers were talking about this as an example of how males and females are taught differently about how to react to different situations or express feelings. And the little boy's mother was quite shocked and said she never thought she gave her son messages about not showing emotion, but that obviously she had. Another example is there's this movie out now called Crazy Rich Asian. And in this movie, the main characters are a male who is Chinese and raised in Singapore and a female who is Chinese and raised in America. And the big crux of the movie is how the man's Singaporean mother does not think that she is a good choice for him to marry because she grew up in the American culture, and that makes things very different. So the whole idea is you can be born genetically Chinese, and you can actually be born with parents who will teach you the Chinese culture. But if you are born in different countries, you will be given different messages. Another example is once I was playing with my nephew, and we were sitting on the floor, and I don't even know what we were doing, and he looked at me and he said, "That's not the point, Lori." Now, my nephew was 4 years old, so I kind of chuckled about that, and I said, "Okay, Don, what is the point?" And he ignored me. So I said again to him, "Okay, Don, what is the point?" And he continued to ignore me. So when my sister came home, I brought this up and found out that this is something she says to him all the time. So he knew where to use it correctly, and he knew to say this, but he had no idea what it really meant. He's got the brain of a four-year-old. He is still pretty concrete. He abstractly could not tell me what the point was. So he really didn't know what it meant. He just knew how to use it. And there are many things that we learn when we're children like that. We take it in with the child's brain, but we don't have the abstract ability to truly understand what's going on. Another example is the anger that we have going on in the American culture right now. There's a lot of anger, and a lot of people like Donald Trump because he doesn't take any crap. This is a simple admiration of aggression, and it's a symbol of a lot of anger and actually a lot of insecurity. This is something that a lot of people in America did not realize, how strong this is in the American culture, because when you're immersed in your culture, it is difficult to see. So another example is the different cultural reactions to people who are gay or transgender, and how there are still countries in the world, in particular in the continent of Africa and in some Arabic countries, where you can be killed or jailed for being gay or lesbian or transgender or anything out of what they consider the normal male and female role. I think it's important, though, to really raise the issue of what we are taught about being male and female. There's actually a group called Hijras in India that don't consider themselves male or female, and that goes all the way back into ancient times. And very often they dress female, and they are within the culture, especially in Mumbai. They are considered kind of mystical, and it goes way back into the history of India. And they give people blessings, and people actually sometimes even invite them to weddings to give blessings. So they're not seen in a negative way at all. But although some of that is changing also within the country of India. So think about this. If you're anyone involved with the LGBTQ community, you must have experienced on some level this discrepancy of being told that you are male or female when you're born, but not feeling that inside. So what must it be like to be told that you're a male or a female due to your body appearance, yet to feel inside that this is not true, not correct? So think about it. So different cultures can see things differently. Like in some cultures, there are no taboos about men crying. In other cultures, anger is actually a sign of immaturity. Thankfully, many of these negative culture messages are changing, mostly for the good. I like talking about toxic masculinity and inequality between men and women in the workforce and violation of people's human rights, especially in the LGBTQ community. So let's stop for a minute and think about all of this. A really insightful, possibly fun way to see some of your software programs or your thinking is to observe someone you don't know, kind of note down what you're thinking about them, and then go and talk to them. Then afterwards, see if your perceptions of them match the perceptions you had of them before you went and talked to them. It's really a kind of cool way to see sometimes how what we see and what we encounter are not the same. So let's stop for a minute and let's think about all of this. What are the main cultural messages that interfere with our having a positive sense of self or high self-esteem? And how do these cultural messages interfere with our happiness? Stop for a minute. Think about it. I'm ML Laurie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests and our contributors, Arlene Kogan, Nancy Alder, The Callouts, Denise Kowalczyk, ML Laurie, and Kristen Thiel. Also, thanks to our web manager and creator, Denise Kowalczyk. Visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living, episode 27, to find links about today's topics and guests. All feedback, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to tpol@kboo.org. And if you'd like to be a guest or a contributor on The Politics of Living, please email us at tpol@kboo.org. We're going to end this episode with a Grammy Award-winning song by Brandi Carlile entitled The Joke. Thanks for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Vicki Mazzone.
Aren't you, boy, with your quiet voice and impeccable style? Don't ever let them steal your joy and your gentle ways to keep them from running wild. They can kick dirt in your face, dress you down, tell you that your place is in the middle when they hate the way you shine. I see you tugging on your shirt, trying to hide inside of it and hide how much it hurts. Discouraged, don't you, girl? It's your brother's world for a while longer. You gotta dance with the devil on a river to beat the stream. Call it living the dream. Call it kicking the ladder. They come to kick dirt in your face, to call you weak and then you have to carry in your baby on your back across the desert. I saw your eyes behind your hair, and you're looking tired, but you don't look scared.